Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who has been in the front lines of that war, lines that are often not recognized as such, but are every bit as important as those of the battlefields that our men and women in uniform serve on so gloriously. It is Europe. It is the place where increasingly enemy operations seem to be on the offense, and increasingly compromises are being made that will change perhaps forever the nature of Europe and certainly the freedoms its people enjoy, with very profound implications for us as well. The woman of whom I'm speaking is Elisabeth Sabatisch Wolf. She is an Austrian by birth. She currently serves as a teacher of English language in Vienna. She has worked in various government roles in the past, including as an assistant to the vice chancellor of her government and in the staff of the Austrian embassy in Kuwait and in Tripoli, Libya. She has come to us, however, through the honing fire of a prosecution that she was subjected to 7 or so years ago by her government for speaking her mind, speaking, in fact, candidly, frankly, factually, about the Prophet Muhammad of Islam. And for that, she has been convicted of a felony offense. She has been fined by her government, and she has been put through the tortures of the damned in a succession of court proceedings, including one we'll speak of that was recently finalized, at least for the moment, by the European Court of Human Rights. She's a dear friend of mine, a much admired colleague, and a real leader, a freedom fighter in the war for the free world. Elisabeth Sabatisch Wolf is with us for a full hour to converse about what she's been experiencing of late. She does it, I'm happy to say, from the United States of America, where she still can speak freely. And I'm delighted she'll be doing so with us in the course of this hour. Elisabeth, thank you for joining us and for giving us so generously of your time.
Well, Frank, it's always a pleasure and a great honor to be on your show with you, and thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, it is a mutual pleasure then. Let me ask you to set the stage for this conversation by talking just a little bit about what it was you did that precipitated all of this in Austria a number of years back. Specifically, what law is it that you violated there?
About 9 years ago, so almost a decade ago, I was invited to hold seminars educating people of all walks of life about Islam, what Islam is all about. And I did so in 3 4-hour sessions, fully sourced. And in one of these sessions, a young journalist from a left-wing magazine infiltrated the seminar and made a secret recording, and the transcript of which was then taken by the magazine to the public prosecutor's office, which then decided to press charges. The law at first during the proceedings that I was accused of breaking was hate speech law, incitement to hatred. It became very clear during the proceedings that this charge wasn't going to fly. And so during the proceedings, the judge, at her own discretion, added another charge which is paragraph 188 of the Austrian Criminal Code, denigration of religious teachings of a legally recognized religion, which in fact is a blasphemy law in Austria. Now, you're going to wonder what I actually said that was so terrible that we had a whole court case and 9 years of fighting in courts. What I said was, and I'm quoting myself verbatim, and I have to make it very clear that I did not say Muhammad was a pedophile, as I am, you know, a lot of commentators have said that I said that. No, I did not say that. What I said was, what do you call the behavior of Muhammad, who at the age of 56 married a 6-year-old girl and consummated the marriage at the age of 9, if not pedophilia?
Yeah, this was considered to be offensive to Muslims, and therefore fell afoul of this law, and you were in this somewhat peculiar fashion then prosecuted for having given such offense. Tell us what happened. What was the outcome of that trial?
The outcome of the trial was that I was fined 480 euros, which is equivalent to about $500, or a 60-day jail. I was invited to spend 60 days in the Austrian jail. I would like to explain also, because it's part of the recent final judgment of the European Court, that it may not sound like a lot of money, $500 US, and The court actually argued, the European court actually argued, well, what is she complaining about? It's only $500 anyway. But the fine was calculated in so-called day fines, and the day fines are dependent on your income. Now, because I lost my job due to this court case back in 2009, I did not have any income. So the fine was calculated at 4 euros a day. Now imagine if I had income at the time, that would have gone up to maybe 100 euros a day, and then you do the math. 120 day fines times 100 is a very hefty sum of money, and 120 day fines is 1/3 of the maximum sentence, which is also kind of surprising, given that I'm a first-time offender, or I was a first-time offender. So I think it's just unfathomable for a court to say, what are you complaining about? It's only $500.
Well, and more to the point, there is the principle. And this is one of the things that I've admired so much about you, Elizabeth Sabatish Wolf, over all these years, in the succession of appeals that you've engaged in, all the way to the Supreme Court of your own country, and then to this other court, the European Court of Human Rights. You've never wavered from the principle that you, as a European, have a right to express yourself. And this is what your case is now testing. And I have to say, it is being sorely tested for reasons that we'll talk about on the other side of a short break. But just to set the stage, Elizabeth Sabatish Wolf is a woman who has been, I really believe, terribly badly abused for standing up for one of the freedoms that we take for granted in this country, and that is increasingly imperiled, I'm afraid, on both sides of the pond, our freedom of expression. We'll speak with her more about what is playing out as we speak in this European Court of Human Rights and what it might mean for you as well, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back for the second installment of this very special interview with Elizabeth Sabatish Wolf, a freedom fighter extraordinaire, fighting specifically not only for her freedom of speech, but I would argue for yours as well. She has been convicted recently by something called the European Court of Human Rights of the grave offense of having apparently not given adequate regard to the so-called religious feelings of others. And I want to ask you, Elizabeth, first, what is this European Court of Human Rights?
Well, the first thing you have to know is that the European Court of Human Rights has nothing to do with the European Union. It's a bit confusing for non-Europeans, but also Europeans alike. So the ECHR has nothing to do with the European Union, but everything to do with the so-called Council of Europe. It is the highest court in the area of this Council of Europe with 57 member states, and it was established in 1959 by the so-called European Convention on Human Rights, which is regarded by some, though definitely not by me, as a sort of European Bill of Rights. Now, if it were a European Bill of Rights, I would probably have no problem with the court system, but I do, so it's not a Bill of Rights. This court's jurisdiction stretches all the way into wonderful human rights upholding countries like Azerbaijan. So you probably understand why this court is not really the place to weigh decisions on matters of human rights. What you have to know about the two important articles that were mentioned in my case were Article 10, freedom of expression, and Article 9, freedom of religion. Now, the problem where I come from, and I come from a very strict interpretation of freedom of speech because I was American educated and therefore have the greatest respect and love for the U.S. Constitution, which includes, of course, the First and Second Amendments. The Article 10 freedom of expression places a lot of restrictions on freedom of expression.
Could we just make clear, Elizabeth Sabatish-Wolf, that it is the gift of government, not an unalienable right, that you have freedom of speech? That's a very important distinction.
That is very correct. And this is, like I said, this is where I come from. I was educated here in the U.S. So for me, to have a European convention granted graciously by the European Convention is something very foreign and, in my opinion, also wrong, as I proved. Now, the court, the European Court of Human Rights, is called upon when all options within a member state of the Council of Europe have been exhausted, which was in my case back in 2011, when I had appealed to the Supreme Court and the verdict was upheld. So we now, my lawyer and I, went to the European Court of Human Rights, and the judgment took about 6 years to come down. And we were very optimistic that the court would overturn my conviction, because this court has a fairly good record on upholding freedom of expression in the Council of Europe area. But it was not to be. And I think we should also discuss the case, the ruling, a little bit in more detail, because it is precisely what is echoed in resolution, United Nations Human Rights Council Resolution 1618. And I'm sure, Frank, you remember Secretary of State Clinton, and she pushed back then in 2012, pushed for this resolution to become law here in the United States, effectively removing the First Amendment from your Bill of Rights.
Yeah. Now, walk through that slowly with us, Elizabeth, because this is something we've talked about on this program over the years quite a bit, but not recently. And I think it's really important that people understand that, again, what's happening in Europe now has bearing on what could happen here, or what is happening, for that matter, in places like this UN Human Rights Council, can have bearing even with respect to God-given unalienable rights like our freedom of expression. So please just tease us out, remind us what the Human Rights Council Resolution 1618 was about.
Yes, Resolution 1618 was adopted unanimously in the so-called United Nations Human Rights Council back in 2012. This resolution targets speech, especially criticism of Islam. You will probably not be surprised if I told you that this resolution was sponsored by the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is the largest voting bloc in the United Nations because it comprises all majority Muslim countries on this planet. The resolution itself targets states to take effective measures to address and combat incidences of religious hatred, and it calls to curtail certain kinds of expressive acts. You'll also not be surprised that this was applauded by Secretary of State Clinton because it overcomes the false divide that pits religious sensitivities against freedom of expression. Now, it's important to note because this 1618 resolution was used as case law for my conviction, the upholding of my conviction by the European Court of Human Rights. 1618 does not mention freedom of religion, but religious sensitivities.
The feelings of others, right?
Feelings of others, but certain others.
Now, here's the thing that's so worrying about this, it seems to me, Elizabeth, and that is that this organization that is completely unaccountable to, you know, the U.S. citizenry, albeit we had a vote in it, but, you know, this resolution could well have passed even if the Obama administration were not very much supportive of it. But it really does involve something, and we've touched on it, but let's just lay this out in a little bit more detail. It basically involves the codification as international law, Sharia blasphemy restrictions. You've lived in Iran. You've lived in, of course, in Kuwait and in Libya. You've experienced firsthand what societies in which Sharia is the law of the land involve. And what does it entail with respect to speech?
Well, a lot of restrictions. And I experienced these restrictions. I specifically remember back in the pre-Amazon years, that living in Kuwait for me was a challenge when it came to reading books, because I couldn't just go to the bookstore. I mean, I went to the bookstore, but the selection was very limited because most of the books are censored by the Kuwaiti government, and a lot of the books never make it into the country, even to this day. And very recently, there were demonstrations held in Kuwait. I think just a few months ago, because so many restrictions are placed on books making it into the country, and people are starting to feel like they're being cheated out of information. Despite the advent of Amazon and the internet and you know, other possibilities. But back then, I did not get the information that I was looking for. Of course, I could read the Quran, but that's exactly what religious sensitivities mean. You, according to Islamic doctrine, all you need is the Quran. There's nothing else a human being, according to Islamic scripture, needs to know. It is the supreme knowledge.
Yeah. And together with the hadiths, the surah, and so on, you have the body of the Quran making up Sharia law. And just to come back to your particular case, of course, in the accounts of Muhammad's life, what you said about his marriage to this young girl, Aisha, at 6, and his consummation, which is a very genteel word for what is child rape, was conducted when she was all of 9 years old. Now, that's a fact according to the sacred texts of Islam, is it not? So when people say that they are offended by you pointing this out, or that you are characterizing it as we do in the Western world, including, you know, in this country for sure, as pedophilia, you didn't say it was pedophilia. You asked it rhetorically, but let's be honest. That's, of course, what it is. That's considered offensive to Muslims, and now you're telling us that as a result of this court ruling by the European Court of Human Rights, it's the law of the land in Europe and breaches beyond as well. Is that right?
It's a problem for the religious sensitivities of a certain religion, but it also entails that there's now a chilling effect. You see, you know, people in Europe, particularly in Austria, they look at me and they think to themselves, well, I better not say anything because I don't want to end up like Elizabeth, without a job, shunned in many places by many people, though that has gotten better due to the influx of so many Muslim so-called migrants into Austria. So people are starting to realize that perhaps not all of Islam is kosher. But the situation is still deteriorating because as long as you talk about the latest iPhone or the latest flat screen plasma TV, all is well. But when you get into the nitty-gritty criticism stuff, and that is precisely what freedom of speech is for and about, that's where you hit a problem.
Yeah. And Elizabeth, we have to pause, but just want to make clear to our audience, when you say that Islam is not kosher, you don't mean literally. You mean that there are problems with it in Western society. Specifically, I believe the problem is Sharia supremacism. We'll continue with our conversation with her momentarily. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by the magnificent Elizabeth Sabadish Wolf, the freedom fighter extraordinaire and a courageous champion of not just her freedom of speech, not just her liberties more generally in distant Europe, but ours as well. And Elizabeth, I did want to just sort of tease out with you. You were talking about how freedom of speech is now being impinged upon in your native Austria. You were not the only person in Europe who has been prosecuted by their governments or others for having had the temerity to point out some of the truths that are so troubling about Sharia supremacism and the faith that embraces it. Talk about some of the others and what kinds of repercussions they're facing as well.
Well, Frank, you and probably many of the listeners are aware of the egregious case against Tommy Robinson in the United Kingdom, who is being continuously persecuted, not just prosecuted, but persecuted by the British legal system. But, you know, it's not all about Tommy and Elizabeth. There are so many nameless people out there who are feeling their government's wrath and are facing criminal charges. Two examples, I just last week read about a case of a Swedish woman who dared to criticize Islam and immigration on Facebook and is currently serving a 3-month sentence in jail, physically in jail, not a suspended sentence, 3 months in jail. That's number one. I also have a close friend of mine in Germany. Nobody knows his name because nobody knows that he even exists, but I'm bringing him up. His name is Ernst Kram, and he hails from the city of Nuremberg, and he's being constantly harassed by the German government, and he's, again, currently facing legal proceedings in his native Bavaria. But, you know, furthermore, don't think it ends with my freedom of speech case in Austria. I am currently also being pursued by the Austrian IRS. Is that a surprise? Probably not. And it's not just two people whose names are out there. For every name out there, there's probably hundreds of people out there whose names will never make it into the news. And we really have to also support these people. So that's why I'm fighting it. Like I always say, Frank, this case is not about Elizabeth. I just happen to be there as a placeholder. This case is about you and me and my daughter and girls who are suffering under Islamic persecution. And I think you're also now working on this horrible FGM ruling here in the United States.
Yes. Well, I did want to come to that. But before we do, if I could, Elizabeth, just to stay with the speech issue for a moment more, you spoke earlier about Hillary Clinton's efforts to try to essentially impose this Human Rights Council Resolution 1618 on us. My recollection is that in the end, she recognized that that would be a little tough to do legally. But what she said explicitly, she and the Obama administration, by inference at least, and presumably others were going to try to do, was to use old-fashioned techniques of shaming and peer pressure to accomplish essentially the censorship, self-censorship, perhaps, of many of us. And Elizabeth, again, you've lived this. Talk a little bit about what it looks like and how you would suggest we're beginning to see this slop over into reaches beyond Europe. I'm thinking specifically of some of the social media platforms that are now part of the problem.
Well, the deplatforming is exactly the peer pressure and shaming that Secretary Clinton was talking about back then. I mean, it took a while for them to catch on, and I'm being facetious right now, but the deplatforming is just another way of censoring people whose opinions are not that of the deep state and the establishment, despite President Trump and despite the new government in Austria, which is doing work that is going in the right direction to put, you know, I'm being very careful about my words here. But the deplatforming is separate from the government. It has nothing to do with it, but again, it has a chilling effect. It makes you think, once again, that maybe I shouldn't get into this talking and should just mind my own business and go about my daily life and feed my kids. And that's exactly what this intends to do, to silence and stifle speech. And what people don't seem to realize is if we don't have more speech, our society is regressing and not progressing. And we're moving so far backwards that I think even the prohibition back in the, 1920s looks like nothing compared to what we're experiencing nowadays. And I'm very concerned that we're being silenced and, well, we are being silenced, but this is the new fad. Like I said, you don't need freedom of expression to talk about the latest iPhone. And the only way we as a society are able to progress is if we talk, if we discuss, if we find new ways of naming certain things, certain activities. And if we can't do that, we as a society are losing massively, and we are already witnessing that.
Let me put a fine point on this. Elizabeth Sabadish-Wolf, again, is our guest from Austria, now speaking freely here in the United States of America, I'm very pleased to say. Elizabeth, one of the reasons we do this radio program every weeknight is to create awareness about challenges our country is facing and to offer specific ideas from brilliant people like yourself about what we can do about it, what, more to the point, we must do about it. The reason that I think it is so insidious that our opponents, our critics, whether it's, you know, the Sharia supremacists, most obviously, a little less obviously, but right joined at the hip with them, are their friends in the left, notably in this country, outfits like the Southern Poverty Law Center. Why they are so intent on silencing us is that the nature of the threat we're facing from such adversaries at the moment is a stealthy one, more or less. It's a subversive but largely under-the-radar kind of effort to transform, fundamentally transform, is the euphemism that President Obama used, of course, our country. And what you're experiencing, what you personally have been living with, is this slow, incremental, well, it's like the boa constrictor, if you want to use that metaphor, squeezing the life out of you, or The other analogy, of course, is to the frog in the water. If it's cool water that's just incrementally raised to a boiling temperature, the frog doesn't have the sense to jump out of it. So I just want you to bring home to us, if you would, what it will look like in America if we don't use the freedom of speech that we have now, and we allow this sort of incremental, stealthy, creeping, but ultimately deadly garroting of our liberties and our constitutional republic to proceed apace. Does it look a lot like what Europe is experiencing right now, and worse, assuredly, in due course?
Well, Frank, I mean, you don't want America to become like Europe when it comes to a lack of freedom of expression, guns taken away from Americans. I mean, this is happening already. Look at Colorado after the midterms. The leftists in Colorado are trying to take away people's guns, and with it, freedom of expression. And that's exactly why I come to the United States so often, is to tell people, look, you don't want to end up like Europe. You need to protect your freedoms. How do you do that? First of all, by voting for the right party. Second of all, you have to be aware of the First Amendment. A lot of people are no longer aware of the rights the First Amendment gives to them. So if freedom of speech is taken away from you, the answer is more speech.
Yeah, amen. So let's turn very quickly to this other thing you alluded to just now, Elizabeth, as another prime example of what's transforming even this country at the moment, as in Europe, I think primarily because of the influx of refugees who practice this horrific, barbaric form of child abuse called female genital mutilation, often on very small female children. You've watched this practice overseas, not literally, obviously, but you've seen the effects on women and girls in countries in the Middle East. What is it likely to mean for women and girls in America if we allow this practice to become, as it is now, as a result of a federal judge's ruling, legal in at least 23 states of this country?
It's mind-boggling, and actually, as a mother of a beautiful, almost 14-year-old, I can't bear to think what this would do to my daughter. What I do know is that it traumatizes girls, and what it also does is it makes the mother complicit in the mutilation of her daughter.
We have to pause for just a second, Elizabeth. We'll be right back with more in our final segment with Elizabeth Sabatish-Wolf right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our final segment with the marvelous Elizabeth Sabatish-Wolf, a good friend of mine and of freedom, and a woman that I'm proud to say has been standing up for it at great personal expense in both the literal sense in terms of costs, but also the physical sense, psychological sense. And we owe her a great debt of gratitude, and it's always a pleasure that she's comes here to share with us insights of her experiences, and we'll conclude this segment with some of her specific recommendations. But Elizabeth, before we do that, I just wanted to ask you to share with us what seem to be some pretty hopeful signs that Europe is, even at this very late hour, awakening to the peril that it is facing. Some say it's too late, at least in some countries. But give us your reading on specifically what's happening in what Don Rumsfeld famously called New Europe, the part of the continent on which you live and further east.
Well, I think the most hopeful thing happening right now is the resistance when it comes to this horrible global compact on migration, safe and orderly migration, which is being, you know, it's being forced upon the peoples of this world, the countries in this world. And it basically, this compact is a horrible document because it concerns only the so-called rights of illegal immigrants into a country. And it doesn't discuss anything about the rights of the indigenous population. But I, along with a close colleague of mine, was able, and I mean it literally, the two of us were able to lobby the Austrian government, and we were able to get the Austrian government to rethink its position on the global compact. And I'm happy to say, to inform your listeners, Frank, that we were able to stop this global migration compact, at least in Austria. And this, yes, it's very satisfying to see that. But not only that, my friend, my colleague, only last week was successful in lobbying the Slovak government to leave the global compact. Now we have an Austrian lobbying the Slovak government, a huge success. Slovakia is out. And this has set up, you know, this has set off a chain reaction. And you look, you know, you see Poland out, Hungary was out already together with the United States. Croatia looks like it's not going to sign. Israel, Japan, Australia, many other countries. Germans are resisting, though we know that Angela Merkel, was instrumental in having this global compact even drawn up. So Germany is going to pass it, of course, with horrendous detrimental effects. But there is a group of countries that is beginning, and I'm saying slowly beginning, to push back. Of course, for my taste, way too slowly, and I'm not sure that it's going to be enough. I fear that it's going to be too little too late. As usual, I hope that I'm wrong. Unfortunately, usually I'm right. But at least there is the resistance. And Frank, you need to look to May of next year, the European Parliament elections. They are going to be crucial. And you have the socialists in Europe already shuddering because it looks like the pendulum will swing the other way, so towards the center right rather than center left. Moreover, another success, you wanted me to talk about successes. Another success was the silencing, the attempted silencing of my free speech delegation at the Organization for Security and Cooperation Conference on Human Rights this year in September in Warsaw, Poland. Thanks to you and your colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, we were able to push that back. It was a very sinister attempt of silencing free speech at that conference, but we were able to push it back. We were able to speak freely, and also thanks to the support of the U.S. delegation in Warsaw, we were able to do that. But if you're not careful and you don't watch out and you're not looking at the situations on the ground every second, the left will push back, and they will push back hard. And that is, if you want to know what I think Americans should do, they should be very vigilant. They should look very hard at their local school boards, what they're trying to impose on their children. They should talk, of course, to their elected officials, representatives. And, of course, they should also support people and organizations like yours, like Center for Security Policy. There's so much to do. You still have all the opportunities here in the United States that we no longer have in Europe.
Well, thank you for that small commercial advertisement. Let me return the favor by just saying, Elizabeth, there is a new pickup team called Friends of Free Speech that has been organized to support you and your efforts to well, defend all of us in a way at this European Court of Human Rights. There is an option to you to pursue an appeal of this most recent adverse ruling. Tell us a little bit about what you're trying to do, what the prospects are, and how people can help.
I have one last opportunity to appeal this latest and basically last ruling of the European Court of Human Rights. I have until January 25th to file the appeal at the European Court of Human Rights to the Grand Chamber, which may or may not accept the appeal. But thanks to the European Center for Law and Justice in based in Brussels and Alliance Defending Freedom, who are currently advising my attorney. So this is a, you know, a very big thing. You know, we have the brightest minds on this case in Europe, but you know, these attorneys have to be paid. So I am here in the United States not only to warn people about what's going to happen, I also need people's support. I mentioned earlier, this case is not about Elizabeth. This is about all of you, both here in the United States and in Europe. And that means we all have to stand together. So I need your financial support. I need your other support in signing the petition that you can find on the website, friendsoffreespeech.org. You will find the petition on that website. Go sign it. I think we have 47,000 plus signatures already. We would like to go as high as 100,000. And people can also donate tax deductible to this website, on this website, to my legal fund. And any money that I don't use for my attorney, because we won the case, will go to those nameless people in Europe so they can also have a defense that is worthy of their cause. Mm.
This is so important. And again, we're processing this through the Center for Security Policy's account so that you can get a tax deductible write-off for your gift to Elizabeth Sabatish Wolf and the Friends of Free Speech. Simply note that that's the purpose you intended to be applied to. And Elizabeth, I can't say how important I think this work is and how a privilege we feel to be able to work with you, whether it's in Warsaw at this Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe or elsewhere on the continent, or for that matter, here in the United States. You participated in a magnificent couple of programs that we did in May, I believe, in the Dallas area, in which we talked about what's happening in Europe. Is it going to come here? And I commend that to people on our website at securefreedom.org. You can see Elizabeth and Katie Hopkins and Rahim Kassam and others talking about that proposition. It's a very bracing and very timely, I think, warning of what we've been discussing that has now become even more evident in the wake of this court ruling. And that appeal is so vital. And I personally believe that the best hope we have that the court will come to its senses and realize that free speech must supersede people's feelings, for heaven's sakes, is to have an outpouring of opposition to what they've done on both sides of the pond, as it's called. And Elizabeth Sabatish Wolf is our leader, and that certainly on the other side, and we always welcome her here. Elizabeth, I hope you'll come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do that tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.